Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Kuf Yud Aleph Amud Bet. The Mishnah begins, Hamakir Kelav Usfarav, person who recognizes his utensils, his Sfarim, that Beyad Acher, that were taken. Obviously here he's claiming that they were stolen, and he recognizes them, and he sees this other person actually has them now. Beyatza Lo Shem Gneva Be'ir. And already there was a rumor circulating, or there was information circulating in the city that there had been a theft at his house. Things had been taken from his house. Ishava lo lokeach, kama natan. Then the purchaser of these items takes a shvua as to the amount that he expended to get these items. Vito, and then he will pay him. Right, we'll get into the Gemara about the details of what happened here, but basically there's hot merchandise out on the market, and then a buyer goes ahead and buys that merchandise, which was stolen from this individual's house. Our assumption is that he did it betom levav, that he was just buying it. He had no idea about this. Part of the reason for the shvua might be to force him to be more careful in terms of buying, because if he is caught with this hot merchandise, even though he didn't intend for it, but he'll have to take a shvua to this, that he was betom levav, that he had no idea. And if he can't take that shvua, then he will not be entitled to the money. If he bought it knowing that it was stolen merchandise, then he doesn't get this ability to be paid out or to be bought out in this case. On the other hand, if he did buy it innocently, we don't want the buyer to lose out. That's going to be come up on Kuf Tav Vav Amud Aleph, which is that there's something called Takanat HaShuk. We want people to be able to go into the marketplace, buy things with the knowledge that they're not going to get it pulled from under them, that they have to worry all the time that it's stolen merchandise. We're going to assume without other information that what they're buying is something that is legal to sell, and that is legal for them to buy. And so there, in order to protect them, we demand that the nigzal pay them in order to get the chevetz back. That's the only right that we give to the nigzal, is his right to obtain the object back, which is stolen from him. But he's got to make restitution to the individual who purchased it. Then he'll go after the ganav for the money or for that price, because now he's got the object back. The only problem is he's out the money that he had to pay for the lokeach. The major question, and this again will come up with the Gemara, is who has to deal with the ganav? Whose responsibility is it to deal with the ganav? Because in the end, we have the chayfetz back. We have the object that was stolen back. The only question is, who's going to get the money from the ganav? Is it the lokeach? Or is it the original owner of the item? V'im lav, if we don't have rumors circulating to that effect, lav kol heimenu, he doesn't have a right to do this. She'ani omer, machran le'acher, v'lachan zeheimenu. Because if there are no rumors circulating that there was theft in the city, there's a theft at his house, then the problem is, he could have sold it to party A, party A sold it to party B, he regrets selling it, and now he says it was stolen, and party B bought it from the thief. And then that's how he's going to get his object back, even though he'll have to expend the money to get it back. But in the meantime, he's doing something to get the object back by claiming there was theft. But how do you know? Which is, how do we know there was a theft, or why do we believe him in that situation? The Baal Yad Tosafot comment on what Rashi says on the Mishnah. Rashi says on the Mishnah, all these cases are cases lifnei yeush. This is all before the Baalim have given up hope of obtaining the item b'chazara. The reason being, if he already has yeush, then we have yeush, v'shinei rishut, and then the buyer is koneh, and the original owner has technically no right to make any demands anymore, because of the fact that it's left his possession. And now he's only entitled to hashava. He's only entitled to get the monies back. He's not necessarily entitled to get the object back. Now, if he did have a direct claim against the lokeach, he could demand the object back. Problem is, once you have yeush v'shinu rishut, he has no claim against the lokeach. His only claim is against the ganav. The ganav does not have the object anymore. So the only thing he can demand is payment. In that case, he won't get the object back. So Rashi says it's clearly lifnei yeush. Tosafot, in discussing why it is that it's lifnei yeush over here, makes a very important comment that has ramifications in many tshuvot, which is, Tosafot says over here, V'nire b'tisfarim havi le'olam lifnei yeush. When it comes to sfarim, by definition, by default, it's always lifnei yeush. She'ein regilot li'tiyayish misfarim. People don't give up hope of getting back their sfarim. Now, the reason being is because they have no inherent value. A sefer only has value for someone who is religiously inclined, or someone in a market where they would utilize the sfarim. So his assumption is that if his sfarim are taken, either the ganav is going to dispose of them because they're not useful to him, or he's going to have to sell it back to a Jew. And since he has to sell it back to a Jew to realize the value, it's going to end up in somebody's hands to whom he can go and make a claim, or he can ask for his sfarim back. For that reason, people don't give up hope of getting their sfarim back. That's number one. As far as kelim are concerned, Tosfot says you have to speak about situations or circumstances in which it's clear that there wasn't yeush. For instance, the owners are running after it, or they're putting up signs looking for it. Things that indicate to us that there wasn't yeush in this case. So kelim would be different than sfarim. Sfarim, the default is that there is no yeush. By kelim, you have to have some sort of indication that the balim don't give up hope. We saw in yesterday's daf, the machloket Rabbi Shimon and the Chachamim, as to what the default status is in a case of Gneva or Gzela. So they are those things that tell us that there's automatic yeush, and you have to counteract that automatic yeush by either indicating you haven't given up hope or chasing it or doing something that indicates otherwise. Why this is so important comes up in a number of tshuvot, the most recent manifestation of them, but where it was a very, very big deal was during the Shoah. Because the Gemara in Bava Metzia says that there is a concept called Zuto Shel Yam, which is that certain objects are lost at sea. They're so lost that it doesn't matter whether the people have given up hope or not. They're considered to be gone. They're considered to have automatic yeush, because any normal person in that situation would have yeush. And even if they're screaming about it, it just doesn't matter because it's completely lost. We'll get there in Bava Metzia that an Aveda is only something that's lost to some people, not to others. Then you have a responsibility to return it. If it's lost to everyone, then in that situation, there's no requirement of a Shavat Aveda because it's considered to be avud, lost legamre. So what happens? You have in the Shoah this tension that comes up, which is you have what the Balei Tosafot say, that nobody gives up hope of getting back their Sfarim. On the other hand, you have a concept of Zuto Shel Yam, where people have given up hope, meaning that there's no chance that anybody will see these items again or have any inkling of finding them or getting them back. So what you have, and there are many instances of this, you can see in Tshuvot post the Shoah, both in terms of the state as a whole, as well as for individuals who came out of the Shoah, who are in possession of Sfarim or items that came out of the Shoah. For instance, one of the Tshuvot deals with the Keter Torah, that this guy goes to Shul, and he's a Nitzol HaShoah, he's a survivor, and then he realizes that the Shul is using the Keter Torah that belonged to him in Hungary, and was taken by the Nazis. And now he wants to give back, because, and he can give all the Simanim, it's his father's name, it's his mother's name on there, can he get it back? Because when he left the town in Hungary, it was gone. Same thing with Sfarim. People come out with Sfarim, whether it's from Batei Midrashot, Sifrei Torah, actual Sfarim, or people's personal libraries that they end up with. What's the status of these items post the war? So the argument made by those in possession of these items is that it's Zuto Shel Yam, that it was things that were lost completely. Nobody had a Havamina that they would see these items at all, mostly because of the fact that they weren't even sure they were going to live to make it through. Weren't even sure that they were going to have their lives. Forget about their possessions. So therefore, there's this automatic Aveda or Ivadon, lost objects. Everybody gives up Yeush. If you're not sure you're going to live, then what are you thinking about your possessions? You're just thinking about the possibility of living. The counter to that is what Balei Tosafot say over here, which is that when it comes to Sfarim, nobody gives up hope of getting them back. Because in the end, it's either going to end up destroyed, or it's going to end up in Jewish hands. And if it ends up in Jewish hands, people don't give up hope of getting it back. Now, part of this is bolstered by the fact that the Nazis themselves preserved many items, even Sfarim or libraries of Sfarim. Meaning they were making the museum of the lost Jew, but much of this stuff is actually found later on by the American armies and the Allied armies afterwards in the hands of government officials. Or governments have, post the war, have these in their possession, and people are trying to get them back. Which is evidence of the fact that it wasn't just going to be destroyed, but rather, it was an item that they preserved or kept. And that gives another side to this, which is, maybe there isn't Zuto Shel Yam, because of the fact that people knew that certain precious items, or objects like this, were kept by the invading armies, by the Nazis at that time, and therefore there was hope that they would get it back. And we see that people, even when they left their houses, buried things and tried to give things to their neighbors in order to get them back. So despite that pressure, we know that people didn't give up hope. Most of the poskim feel that there is this issue of no yeush by Sfarim, and that there is a responsibility to give it back to the original owners, Whether that's because of Asita Yashar Vatov, which means it's Lifnim Ishur Tadin, but if you know the owners, and now it's post-war and you can give it back to them, that there is a value in giving it back to them, not by legal means, but Lifnim Ishur Tadin, because of the spirit of the law, that you should get it back to its rightful owner. There are others who say it even from a legal standpoint, that you have an obligation to give it back, because of this issue of there was no Yeush. And the Sri Deish, in one of his tshuvot, speaks about this. He's speaking to a chaver. Both of them escaped from Europe. And Sri Deish himself is bemoaning the fact that he lost all of his Sfarim and he has nothing left from there. But this other individual made out with Sfarim from the Beit Midrash. And he's asking him, what's his obligation in terms of giving them back the Beit Midrash, or should he keep them? And the Sri Deish says, for sure you have to give them back the Beit Midrash. You might be able to keep them on long-term loan because, of course, the Gabayim are going to be indebted to you that you saved these items. And that's part of the issue here. People risked their lives or did things to recover these Sfarim. What is their entitlement? Then once they've either risked their lives or they've paid out money in order to do this. So can they be reimbursed, or are you obligated to reimburse them? In most cases, there may not be any obligation to reimburse them because they were under no obligation to pay the money in order to save them. In all these situations, it's not clear that the Sfarim would have been lost for certain had they not paid the money. In cases where it would have been certain loss, then the poskim are more specific as whether they're entitled to the actual item. And the question is, how obvious was the loss? Were they about to use it for toilet paper, rip it up and burn it, and you saved it in that case? Or simply, that was the belief about what would have happened had you not bought it. So all of these play into all the tshuvot, but it's really the tension of this Tosfot that there's no yeush by Sfarim that comes up in these situations or these issues. All right, the Gemara says, V'chi yatzalo shem gneva beir. My havi, so what? That there's a shame gneva in the ear. Why does that change anything? Who says that the reason that there's a rumor circulating that they were stolen is an objective rumor? Let us say he sold it to someone, he regrets it, so now he makes up the rumor. He's the one starting the rumor in order to be able to get his objects back. People came and stayed at his house, and then in the middle of the night, he starts screaming that they walked out with his stuff, they've left with his stuff. V'amar nignavu kelai. My objects, my possessions have been taken, meaning that he makes it obvious that there's a theft going on in real time. Where it says, koshikein ilamatza. That's the best acting, that's the best scenario for him. He gets up in the middle of the night, starts screaming that there was a theft. Now he's trying to reinforce this idea that there really was a theft. We have no evidence, we need third-party corroboration of the fact that there was a theft here. So Rav Kahana, Misayim ba Mishmei de Rav, so that's what Rav Kahana adds on in the name of Rav, G'on she'ayta machteret chatura b'toch beito, meaning that there was a tunnel that went into his house, which was the main way of theft in those days, which is the best way to get into the stone house was to dig underneath the foundations and come up. So now there's a tunnel there, U'bnei Adam shilanu b'toch beito, and there were people who were staying in his house. He had visitors or guests in his house. And all of a sudden, he wakes up in the middle of the night and says that there were thieves here and they took my stuff. Meantime, there's a tunnel out of his house, which they left by. And we know, Yatsu, ve'anburakaraot shokelim al kitfehem. And they were going with sacks of items on their back, meaning that there's good circumstantial evidence here that there was a theft. We have a tunnel, we have people going out with sacks on their back, and him claiming that the things were gone. So here we have overwhelming evidence that there probably was a theft, and this wasn't just a made-up heist or story that he wants to get his object back. V'akol omrim, and everyone says, nignavu kelav shoponi, that so-and-so's items were stolen, meaning it's so obvious there was a theft here, then it's objectively now verified that we had a theft. V'dilma, kelim havu, sfarim lo havu. Our Mishnah says, it's kelim and sfarim, how do you know what they took to say? Maybe now he makes the decision, everything I've sold in the last year was in this theft, that way he can get back everything that he sold in the last year. Amar Rabbi Chir Bava, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, kagon tamrei nami sfarim. People say, no, not only were his utensils stolen, but his sfarim were stolen. Who says that what was stolen is what he's making a claim on? Maybe they stole small items, and he's making a claim on a larger item. They identify particularly the sefer that was taken. Over here, when we're talking about sefer, we're not talking about printed books like today. Sfarim in those days involved like a Sefer Torah or any of the other books, but it was something that was a serious possession. that people would have noted when somebody walks out with it. So if somebody walked out with something, there was ways to identify, it was clear that this was, they were taking something that belonged to him or was unique to his property. How do you know what the age of the sefer was? Maybe it was an older one and now he's making a claim for a newer one. So not only do we have this evidence of the fact that there was a heist or a theft over here, but people recognize that this belongs to him, that this is his sefer. It's unique enough that when people see it in this buyer's hands, they go, ah, this belongs to so-and-so. This is so-and-so's property. Mar says, wait a minute. So we had before, and we have here being quoted in the name of Rav, Rabbi Yehuda Marav, that the scenario here is where they dug a tunnel out and they went with the stuff and people saw them leaving with bags on their back. So everybody knows there was a theft. Who says that the individual has a claim to take these items back? Because Amarav, Ababa Machteret, Vinatal Kelim, someone who tunnels into the house and then steals possessions, Viatza, and then goes out, Patur, he does not have to return those items because of Kamle Bidarabimine, which is, we know from the Torah, Ababa Machteret, an owner who stands up to someone tunneling into his house. The assumption is that the person tunneling into his house, if someone blocks his way or stops him, that he has in mind to kill whoever blocks him or stops him in that situation. Therefore, we allow the balim, the owners, to preemptively protect themselves and to kill the person that is coming in above machteret. And if he kills him, he is innocent because he was defending himself, because had he not killed him, the guy would have killed, the baba machteret would have killed the owner. So he has a right to kill him. The right to kill him makes that the person who's Baba Machteret is subject to a death penalty. If you're subject to a death penalty, Kamlai de Rabbi Mine says that the death penalty is your punishment. Any monetary or incidentals that come from that, you do not have to repay or you are patur from. So here he was Baba Machteret, and you stole at the same time. What you stole, he says you are kone bidamim. You acquire it through your blood, in essence, which is that you're chayav mita, and therefore the acquisition of the items is not subject to the regular rules of zvei shivet egzela asher gazal. And that's what the Gemara says, my time up. Why is that? Bidmei kaninhu, that they acquire it through the blood. Hani mili de kaninhu b'bama mechteret dimi ikara masar nafshe l'ktala. That's only true if both the entrance and the exit were accomplished through the digging of a tunnel. In our situation, they got into the house because they were guests. The egress was done through a tunnel out, but they didn't tunnel in. Avahani, Kevin Dolo Masru Nafshay Luktal Alo. Over here, they're not considered to be a haba bimachteret, someone who enters through a tunnel. They entered in a case that they were guests. They exited through a tunnel. That case, they're not subject to a death penalty. The death penalty is only when a person's risking their life to get inside the house. That's when they're subject to a death penalty, because the fact that they're risking the life means that they will kill anyone who gets in their way in order to carry out the theft. Over here, they already had access because they were in the house. They were just trying to leave. And therefore, that Baba Machteret is not kone, or there's no kamle de rabbi mine in that situation. There's an underlying assumption there. If the balim stand up to them, that the ganab will kill the balim. So therefore, is abalachor gecha hashkem lor go. It's assumed to be a defensive killing because the ganab will kill the balabayit if the Baal Bayit doesn't preempt him. Now, the Torah says, im yatzal lav ha-shemesh, if it's obvious that the ganav is not going to kill here, the Gemara gives the only example where it's obvious, which is a father coming to steal from a child, that they will not kill their child. In that case, you do not have permission to kill them. That means that if the person's life is not in danger, then it's not automatic. You can't just go and kill people to protect your possessions. If you kill someone to protect your possessions, then you are subject to manslaughter charges, to killing. You used excessive force to protect your possessions. That's not allowed. The only time you're allowed to do this is in a defensive manner where your life is at risk. If your life's at risk, then we say, Ashkim lehor go, then take defensive action. But if that's not the case, you have no right to kill to protect your possession. Kamlei d'rabba minei is technically only involves a case where he is chayav mita. In this case, he walks out. In the end, he will not be chayav mita. But that's what we have Tana d'Bei Chizkia earlier in the Masechta that says, even in situations of shogeg, even in situations where they don't actually get the chiyuv mita, the fact that they were required or should have gotten a chiyuv mita is enough to make kamlei d'rabbi minei. Kamlei d'rabbi minei applies even without the actual death penalty, even out a court execution commonly the Rambam applies if the person has reached the position where they should be subject to a death penalty, even if it's b'shogeg, not even mezid, that triggers commonly the Rambam mina. It doesn't have a requirement of shivik zeis asher gazel. We've spoken about it before. The Ktzot Achosh and others who believe, let's say yidei shemayim, he does have to give the objects back and he has to return them. But we can't legally compel him to give the objects back. That's the only thing that comes out of here. However, lo shanu elo bala bayit asulim kor kelav. That's only true bala bayit who is normally selling his items. I mean, this is it's possible or plausible that he sold the item or it was stolen. So we have to figure out which happened over here. That's why we need all of this evidence or circumstantial evidence that there was a theft over here. But aval bala bayit she'ina asulim kor kelav, someone who doesn't normally sell their kelim, we don't need so much evidence behind him. Rashi says that you don't need that final stage of evidence, which is sefer ploni uploni, that this specific object was taken and they're identifying the particular object that was taken. You don't need that much evidence. You need all the other pieces of evidence that there was a theft. You can see here already the Ot Aleph of the Gra, which indicates that there are other Rishonim, including the Rambam, who believe that you need very little evidence at this point in time. You just need that there was a gneva that was there. You need some indication or that there was a gneva, and that's sufficient because this person doesn't sell his items. And since he doesn't sell his items, as long as we know there's a gneva, the fact that someone else is in possession of their items already is now corroborated or substantiated by the fact that there was this rumor of a gneva. V'dilma itzterchle zuzei v'zobin. How do you know it wasn't a circumstance where he was under duress? You're right, he doesn't normally sell his items. But this was a situation in which he was under duress, and therefore he had to monetize some of his possessions. Meaning that there's already rumors circulating that there was a theft in the city. And so if we put those pieces together, it doesn't make so much sense. If he doesn't normally sell, and there's already rumors of a gneva out there prior to with this happening, therefore, if you put the pieces together, it makes the most sense that there was a theft and that he didn't sell under duress. Selling under duress is an unusual circumstance. Gneva might be also unusual, but here we have outside evidence to the fact that there was something going on or there was a gneva. And so therefore we'll lean towards the probability of gneva versus someone selling under duress. Right now, itmar. Ganav umachar v'acharka chukara ganav. It's a situation where there was a theft, then umachar, and it was sold. So now it's in the possession of a third party who had nothing to do with the gneva. Again, assumption that he bought it innocently, had no idea. And now he's in possession of the stolen goods, unbeknownst to him, but that's what he purchased. But they also know the identity of the ganav. So here is the question about who has to deal with the ganav. Who's the one who's going to have to make the claim? Is it the original balabait that's got to make the claim? Or is it the buyer who's going to have to make the claim? Who is out the money that has to now go after the ganav? And again, here, we know the ganav. That makes all the difference. Because again, we're going to get to in the Gemara, Takanat HaShuk, which says that we protect buyers. That'll be only in a situation where we don't know the identity of the thief. Because in that case, we're not going to obligate the buyer then to go and find it and try to get his money back. But once we know the identity of the thief, then the buyer has a high likelihood of recovering his money. He just has to go through the efforts to recover it. In that case, there may not be a takanat hashuk, and that's what the question revolves around here. Who is obligated to go after the ganav? Rav Mishmei de Rabbi Chiya Amar Hadin Ima Rishon. The din is with the first one. The way Rashi reads this is that the bala bayit has to go after Dima Rishon. The Rishon is the ganav, the first possessor of his possessions. Yochanan Mishmei de Rabbi Yani Amar Hadin Ima Sheni. The bala bayit goes after the lokeach. And then obviously if he goes after the lokeach, then the lokeach will have to go after the ganav. Now, even when he goes after the lokeach, right now it's not clear that he would have to even compensate him in this case, meaning that he can go after the lokeach, get his object back, because we know it's a stolen object, and then the lokeach would go and get his money back from the ganav. In other instances, and we'll see in a second, there might be an obligation, like in our Mishnah, for him to pay the lokeach, and then he'd have to go after the ganav. So even though he can grab the chayfetz and he's entitled to do that, he'll have to make reparations for that. And then he would still be the party that was needing to go after the ganav. But in this situation, or so far, the assumption is that the balabait either has to go after the ganav, or according to Rabbi Yochanan, the lokeach will have to go after the ganav. In either case, the balabait will get his object back. So now, I'm Rabbi Yosef, lo plige. Rabbi Yosef claims that there's no argument here between Rabbi Yochanan and Rav. Kan lifnei Yeush is one in situation or scenarios when it was before Yeush. Then a dinner mesheni. Then he has a right to go after the second party, because without yeush, that means that the second party is also a gazlan, maybe unbeknownst to him, but he's in possession of stolen property that he has yet to acquire. It still belonged to the original owner. When it belongs to the original owner, it's in his possession. The original owner has an issue even with the buyer now, because he's in possession of his object. Kan achar yeush. On the other hand, after yeush, hadina mirishon. Then the Baal HaBayit is only entitled to go after the Ganav, not after the Lokeach, because in that situation, when the Lokeach had it in his possession, it was already out of the possession of the Baal HaBayit, because he had Yeush. Yeush and Shini Rishut result in an acquisition by that party. For that reason, he doesn't have any right to go after the Lokeach. He only has a right to go after the Gazlan that took it originally. V'tarvayu itluhu de Rav Chista. And they both subscribe to that position of Rav Chista, which is that Rav Chista said, if you remember on the previous Mishnah, that Rav Chista said that when there is no Yeush, that the Baal HaBayit has a right to go after either of the parties. Meaning, when there's no Yeush, he can make the choice to whether go after the Gazlan or to have to go after the second Gazlan. Meaning that he has a choice in that matter because it never left his possession. That means anyone in possession of the object is a thief. Even though they're unbeknownst to them, they might be a thief, but they own someone else's property, and therefore he has a right to go after either party. If that's true, that everybody, Tarvayu Idluhu Rav Chista, then the statements over here of Rav Yochanan, who's going to say that you can go after the second party, he's going to say, Af Akar Sheni, he's also entitled to go after the Ganav, because of the Rishon and Sheni here. According to Rav Chista, you have rights, Bifnei Yeush, to go after either party. And so if that's the case, he could exercise his right to go after the Rishon and the Sheni. Obviously, going after Lokeach is easier for him, because the assumption is that it's going to be much harder to get the money back from the Ganav than it is from the Lokeach, who is more of an innocent party, rather than the Ganav, who intentionally stole. So according to Rabbi Yochanan right now, it would be no, he would not have to reimburse him. He would take it, and then the other, he will have to go after the Ganav. The Lokeach will have to go after the Ganav. So the difference is, if you have a right to go after the Sheni, that right to go after the Sheni is without compensation to the Sheni, without compensation to the Lokeach. If you don't have a right to go after the Sheni, then you have to go after the Ganav, or if you're going to get your object back, then you have to pay the Lokeach for the object, and then you still will have to go after the Ganav, even though you can get your object back because of the fact that it is a stolen object and it does belong to you. So the question of compensating the Lokeach revolves exactly around this issue as to whether you're entitled to go after the Lokeach. If you're entitled to go after the Lokeach, then you can take it without compensation, and the din is between the Lokeach and the Ganav. If the case is that you're not entitled to go after the Lokeach, then you might be able to buy it back, give him the money and buy it back, assuming that we have information that there was Ganav, and in our case it's Hukara Ganav, we know there was a theft, and then you'll have to go and make the claim against the Ganav to get the money that you gave to the Lokeach back, that you're out. Because now you have your object back, you're still out the money that you have to go after the Ganav for. Elmer Abayi, Rabbi says back to his Rebbe Rav Yosef, Velo Plige? Do they not argue? Ha matnot knuna kilifnei yeush dami? When it comes to matnot knuna, which have a status of being like lifnei yeush, uplige, and we know that they argue. And that is, matnot knuna we're speaking about here are matnot knuna from a behemat chulin, which is zroa, lechaim, and the keba. These are the parts of the animal that the kohen is entitled to. There is no yeush over here, either because the kohen assumes that he can always make a claim, no matter who has it, because it never leaves his possession, or the fact that they are granted to him min hashamayim, that God granted him these gifts, they take on a higher status of, I'm entitled, and therefore I'll never give up hope, because the assumption is that someone's going to do the right thing, and give the Zerua Lechaim and the Keba to the Kohen. So since they are deemed to be like Lifnei Yeush, dummy, Uplige, and we have a Machloket, it's none. Amar lo, Mechor li, Me'aha Shel Para. Sell me the innards of the cow. Vayu Behen Matanot. And included in that is the gifts to the Kohen, the one that would be embedded there is the Keba, the stomach that the Kohen would be entitled to. So amongst the innards that he's buying is this stomach that will have to go to the Kohen. Note on the Kohen, Ve'enu Menachelo Min Adamim. The tabach, the butcher, gives that to the Kohen, and he doesn't deduct for the price. So if the person came and they fixed the price together for the innards of the animal, the assumption is that when he buys that, he knows that he's not entitled to the keba, and therefore the price that he gave was excluding that which would go to the Kohen. Therefore the tabach has a right to separate that out, give it to the Kohen, and not charge any less for it. Okay, lakach emenu b'mishkal. If he bought it by weight. So now, when you buy it by weight, and the stomach's in the weighing, then when you're paying by weight, the guy has paid for the value of the stomach in there. Therefore, notno the kohen, the butcher gives it to the kohen, umenachelo min adamim. And now he has to deduct from the price that he charged the buyer, Because it's clear here that the buyer paid for the stomach, because he weighed it, and that was part of the weight that was included in the price. Vamarav, lo shanu ela sheshakal li atzmo. That's only true if he weighed it himself. Aval shakal lo atabach, hadinim atabach. That's only when the individual was shokel, he weighed it himself. Then the Kohen can go after this guy and get his matnat kuna, and then that guy will deduct the money from the tabach. On the other hand, if the tabach himself was the one who weighed it, the tabach then becomes a gazlan. Because, in essence, he put in the weight of what he was selling to this other individual, the matnot kuna. He left his stomach in there. And now when the Kohen is coming to make a claim, his claim is against the tabach, who was a gazlan, and not against the buyer. So what you see here is that Rav says that in particular, his claim is against the tabach, and not in general. So Gemara says, Ema af dinim atabach. Not that exclusively your din is with the Rishon, but you also have a right to go after the tabach, but that does not preclude your right to go after the buyer in this case. So that is, because what you would have thought is that the matnot kuna cannot be stolen, kamash malan, that they can be stolen. And what the tabach did was steal them, and therefore you can go after the tabach. Had it been that the tabach was not considered to be a thief, your only right would be to go after the buyer in that situation, because the buyer is the one in possession, he's the one who weighed it. He's the one who now the Kohen goes after. The Tabach has nothing to do with it. On the other hand, if you believe the Tabach can steal the Matanot Kuhuna, then you can go after the Tabach as well. So that's the Chiddush that Rav is giving you, that you have a right to go not only after the Lokeach, but you also have a right to go after the Tabach. And the reason he's telling you about the Tabach is because there's a Chiddush there, that there is Gzela, Yedei of the Tabach, and that's why the Kohen has a right to go after the Tabach or the Lokeach in that situation. And since the matnot kuhuna are granted to the Kohen by a Kodesh Baruch Hu, you would think that would be impossible to steal such an item. So the kamash falon is that even though you technically can't take it away from the Kohen, the tabach's action is a maisa gezel, and therefore that puts him into the fray, quote-unquote. It makes him responsible that the Kohen can go after him, not just after the lokeach. According to Abaye, who says that Rav and Rabbi Yochanan are really arguing, and it's not a reconcilable machloket like Rabbi Yosef had suggested, but my plige, what's their machloket about? Bidder Rav Chista, exactly that issue of Rav Chista. And as Rashi points out, that's plige belifnei Yeush. It's an instance when it was before Yeush. And then they argue in Rav Chista, once you're lifnei Yeush, is there a din of Rav Chista or not? Rav says Rav Chista's din does not apply, and therefore you only have a right to go after the gazlan himself. Whereas Rabbi Yochanan believes that Rabbi Yechista is correct, and if it's lifnei Yeush, the second gazlan, or the second party here, is equally exposed as the first party. And therefore you can go after the sheni as well. You can go after the lokeach as well. Rav Zvid Amar, kigon shenitya ashu abalim biyad lokeach, velo nitya ashu biyad ganav. That the explanation of the machloket here revolves around a situation or a circumstance in which there was no Yeush. The Baam Lim didn't give up hope of getting it back or retrieving it while it was in the hands of the Gazlan. But once it reached the hands of the buyer, then they had Yeush. Ubehaplige, and this is their machloket. Mar Savar Yeush Vachar Kach Shinoi Rishut Kani. That if you have Yeush first, and then you have Shinoi Rishut, that generates a Kinyan, to which the object then is in the hands of whoever has it at that point, and the Baam Lim have no method of retrieval. They only have recourse against the thief then to make him pay. Shinui Rishut, on the other hand, if the change in ownership or possession happened first, v'acharkach Yeush, and then only afterwards did the Baam Lim give up hope of retrieval, lo kani, that does not work, or that's not successful in generating a kinyan. Umar Savar lo shna. And the other opinion view is that there's no difference. So according to Rav Zvid, if it was lifnei Yeush, everybody subscribes to Rav Chista, and therefore you have a din in Masheni, you can go after the lokeach. But here, their machloket revolves around this issue of when Shinui Rishut precedes Yeush. Does that generate a kinyan or not? Rav says, yes, it generates a kinyan, and therefore you can only go after the Rishon, after the Gazlan. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan believes that it does not generate a kinyan, and therefore you go after the Sheni, because the Sheni here is equally liable, or the object has not come into his possession in a way that the Baam Lim don't still own it. And since the Baam Lim still own it, he is the equivalent to the original Gazlan under the rule of Rav Chista. Now, the reason that you would differentiate between Yeush and then Shin Rishut versus Shin Rishut and then Yeush is because what about the fact that there is a Shin Rishut in the fact that the Gazlan or the Ganav took it away from the Baalim? Isn't that a Shin Rishut? So one way to formulate that is that the reason that it's not considered Shin Rishut when it comes into the hands of the Gazlan is because of the Rishonim like the Ramban who believe that that's a problem of Ateliyade Bisura. The problem of why Yeush by itself is not successful in generating a Kinyan. This is what the Ramban suggests, that Yeush by itself should be successful in generating a Kinyan. The failure is because the individual who's in possession of it, the Gazlan, it came into his possession be Isura. And that prevents the ability of Yeush by itself to generate the Kinyan. Once you have a Shinoi Rishut, that Shinoi Rishut takes it out of the hands of the Gazlan and puts it into someone's hands who's getting it bit, quote-unquote, behetera, after the Yeush. So if the Yeush precedes the Shin Rishut, then the next party has acquired the object Behetera. Since Yeush by itself technically is a form of Kinyan, but it can't be that it came into your possession Bisura. So therefore the Gazlan doesn't have Shin Rishut, because his Shin Rishut preceded the Yeush, and his coming into his possession was Bisura, and therefore the Yeush can't help him. On the other hand, for the third party who the Gazlan sells it to, that Shinui Rishut is successful because that is a Shinui Rishut that after Yeush, and that Yeush makes it now that it goes into the hands of the Lokeach Behetera. And that's the reason that you would say that Yeush before Shinui Rishut makes a difference, whereas the other way around, Shinui Rishut and then Yeush won't help you because the Shinui Rishut by itself doesn't take away the Isur. And as long as it comes into your possession, be'isur, the Yeush won't work to make a Kinyan. So that's one way to formulate or explain why there's a difference. The other tzad might have to do with what the Sefer HaMaknes says with regards to Shin Rishut and Yeush, which is that each one of those items produces a removal of the item from the possession of one of the two parties. The Yeush removes it from the possession of the Baalim, and the Shin Rishut takes it out of the possession of the Gazlan. And so what you need is Yeush and Shin Rishut in order to get it clean from this whole situation or circumstance. So in that scenario, you could argue that there should be no difference as to whether the Shin Rishut happens first and then the Yeush, or the Yeush and then the Shin Rishut. As long as both of them are accomplished in the end, then you've removed it from the hands of the Gazlan and you move it from the hands of the Nigzal. And that's why this party has a Kinyan on the object. So in that way, if you explain the idea or concept of Yeush and Shin Rishut in that way, then it would make sense not to differentiate in the order. On the other hand, if you believe that the Shin Rishut is a way to get into the possession of the other person, Behetera, then you have to have the release of the object before that, and then you would need the Yeush to precede it, and that's why you might believe that Yeush with Shin Rishut works, but the reverse does not work. But Papa Amar, Biglima, the Kuliyama Loplige, the Hadar the Marit. When you're talking about a cloak, then everybody agrees that it goes back to the original owner. And the question here is whether there is a Tanakanata Shuk. So according to Rav Papa, everybody agrees if it's before Yeush, we hold like Rav Chista. And that means if it's before Yeush, you can go after either party. If he has the right to go after either party, then the Lokeach doesn't have the right to withhold the object. And the Baalim can demand the object. They don't have to pay for it because both parties are party to the Gezel over here, even though the Lokeach, unbeknownst to him, is a party to this, but since it remained in the possession of the owner, he can go after either party, confiscate, or take back his goods, and then the Lokeach, the buyer, will have to deal with the Ganav. The question is, in a situation in which there was a purchase, and whether there's this concept called Takanat HaShuk. Takanat HaShuk is an institution by Chazal put in place to protect buyers in the marketplace, so that when they buy in a open marketplace, in a public forum, where there's no clear indication that it's Gezel, in order to protect purchasers, we say that even if it was a hot item, even if it was merchandise that was stolen, they will not be responsible for that, because if we do not give them that indemnification, then people will be reluctant or wary of buying things, because they might always be on the hook for the fact that it's Gezel. So in order to clear that from the decks, Chazal gave an exemption to the Lokeach in those cases where he doesn't have to return it. The question is, do you have the Takanat HaShuk or not? Now, the statements of Rav and Rav Yochanan now are not referencing to the original Baalim, but rather to the rights of this buyer. The way that we had explained it until now, the Rishon was that the Baal had to deal with the Ganav, and then the Sheni was that the Baal had to deal with the Lokeach. Now, the way the Gemara is reading, or the way Rav Papa is reading it, is that the Rishon and the Sheni is who the Lokeach has to deal with. And that's what he says here. Rav Mishmei, the Rebbe Chiya Amar, Hadina Merishon. The dinas with the Rishon mean from the perspective of the buyer, Dina de Lokeach, the Lishkol Zuze Miganav. He has to go after the Ganav. Velo Asobo Tokanot Hashuk, and they don't protect him with the Takanat Hashuk. Meaning that this indemnification doesn't work here, and he has to go back and get it from the Ganav. The reason that that's the case is because Hukara Ganav. Because we know who the thief is. And as the Rashba points out, and I mentioned this before, this is only true Behukara Ganav. Rashi mentioned it above, that if it's Shlohukara Ganav, we do protect the Lokeach no matter what, because over there we're not going to burden him with the necessity to go after the Ganav. But where we've identified the Ganav, then we will say to him, give the object back, and now you go after the Ganav. Rabbi Yochanan Mishumayana Yamar Hadinim Hasheni, meaning that the Lokeach has to go after the second party, which here is, Dina Lokeach Lishkol Mibal Habayit. The second party to the Lokeach is the Baal Habayit, that's the second derivative claimant over here. Vasabo Takanat Hashuk, and they still protected him with Takanat Hashuk. So the Machloket here revolves around this question of when we know who the Ganav is, who's the burden of payment on? According to Rav, the burden to extract the money from the Ganav is on the Lokeach. Because here, the Takanat HaLokeach or Takanat HaShuk is not so relevant. Because he will get his money back, because we know who the Ganav is. He'll just have to work on getting it back. And therefore, the Chachamim didn't institute Takanat HaShuk in that case. Rabbi Yochanan says, no, the Takanat HaShuk is far-reaching and broad. If you're a buyer, that's it. You're exempt. You don't have to do anything. And therefore, the buyer can demand that the Baal, who comes and takes his object back, that he pay him. And then the Baalim will have to go after the Ganav. So even in Behukar HaGanav, Rabbi Yochanan says that the Lokeach still has protection of Takanat HaShuk, but Rav says no. And again, both of them will agree in a case where we don't know who the Ganav is, that Takanat HaShuk is still relevant. Now Rashi notes over here, according to Rabbi Yochanan, who says Takanat HaShuk is in effect all the time, then when is Rav Chista's din ever applicable? When can you go after both parties when it's Lifnei Yeush? So Rashi over here notes that it's only in a case where the Lokeach is an innocent Lokeach. That's the situation when you have Takanat HaShuk. In situations where either the second party is a thief and he stole it from the first party, or in a situation where the buyer knew that it was stolen items or stolen goods, in that case, then Rav Chista's din would apply. Even Rav Yochanan would agree that you can go after the first Gazlan or the second Gazlan, or you can go after the buyer just as much as the Gazlan, because over there, the buyer wasn't just an innocent victim of circumstances. Rav says, V'savar Rav lo asabo takanat hashuk. Is that really true that Rav thinks that there is no institution of takanat hashuk here? V'Rav Huna talmidei de Rav Hava. Rav Huna was a talmid of Rav. V'chanan Bisha ganav glima. Chanan Bisha, who he bumped into before in the Masechta, this evil Chanan, who used to damage people, hurt people. We saw before that he had done something to somebody's ear and he was being penalized by the Beit Din, and when he didn't have change, he did it again in order not to have to take the change back. So here he stole somebody's cloak, Vizavno, and then he sold it to a third party. Ata de kamei de Rav Huna. So they came before Rav Huna, the Baalim and the Lokeach. Amalei lau gavra zil shari avitach. So he said to the owner, go redeem your mashkon, meaning that you have to pay the Lokeach for the fact that he's giving you back the cloak, which is like the shita of Rabbi Yochanan, not Rav. Over here we know who the Ganav is, it's Chanan Bisha. And yet, Rav Huna is telling the owner to go pay the individual, the Lokeach, in order to get his cloak back. So if that's the case, Rav also thinks in that case there's Takanat HaShuk. It says, Shaini Chanan Bisha, Kevin Deleke Lishtalumi Minei, Kalohukar Ganav Dami. Since Chanan Bisha was a very difficult person, someone maybe even who was above the law, so therefore, even if you know that he's the thief, you still can't extract the money from him. And so it's the equivalent of not knowing the thief. For the Lokeach's perspective, because if he gives it back to the Baalim without compensation, it's very unlikely that he will get his money back. That's the equivalent of Shlohukara Ganav. And in that case, we will invoke Takanat HaShuk, even according to Rav, because the whole idea is to protect the Lokeach from loss. Now, we will let him lose money if he can get it back in a short period of time or through some tircha. But where here we know that he's unlikely to get it back, there's a low probability of recovery, there Takanat HaShuk would apply, even according to Rav. And now, Amarova, Im Ganav Mufursamu, Lo Asabu Takanat HaShuk. If there is a famous Ganav, a famous thief, then you don't get the protection and the indemnification of Takanat HaShuk. I mean, then the buyer should be beware. He's purchasing from someone who's a well-known thief. He's got to expect that the items that he's buying are items that are very likely stolen. And if that's the case, he is taking the risk when he buys from this individual. So Rava says that this all applies when the Lokeach is quote-unquote innocent in the situation. In a case where he should have made an assumption or should have known that it was taken from a thief, there, he's buying from a thief, then it's his responsibility or it's his problem. Chanan Bisha is a well-known bad person. So why is it that over there, Rav Huna still paskin that Takana Shuk was in effect, and they still put that in place and forced the Balim to pay for the cloak? It says, Nehi de Mefursam de Bishuta. Yes, he was infamous for his evilness, or for his bad behavior, or for hurting people, the Gnevuta lo Mefursam, but he was not as infamous for his theft, meaning that he wasn't normally a thief, he didn't normally steal, he was not good to be, but he was a very difficult person, and he hit people and hurt people. But as far as theft, he was not involved in that. So when you buy something from him, you don't have to assume that you're purchasing it from a ganav. Itmar, ganav ufara bechuvo, ganav ufara behekefo. If a person steals something, and then he utilizes the stolen object to pay back debts that he has outstanding, or credit that he has with the store, lo asubo takanat hashuk. We do not apply takanat hashuk in that situation, because these people are not what we call innocent buyers. Because the Amri Lava died to the Hanu Yavit Lemide. The person originally loaned the money to the person who is now a thief, but they lent the money not relying on the fact that they were going to get this particular object or this particular item. And so therefore, when the Ganav comes and brings it to them to repay them, that's new information in the case. It's a new situation in the case. And so therefore, they don't need buyer's protection, because the fact that they accepted it as repayment is not that they put out expenditures or they put out money. The money was already lent. The money was already spent. This is just a repayment, and therefore they're not given the protection of Takanat HaShuk. Mashkanto. If a person lends out money on collateral, if the collateral is Shavei Matan Bimeya, if he gives a loan of 100 against collateral of 200, then Asubo Takanat HaShuk. In that case, he does have the protection afforded by Takanat HaShuk, because this individual only lent money to this party because of the collateral that was posted. Now we find out that the collateral that was posted was really stolen. So then he would not have lent the money had it not been for the collateral. So the collateral was the vehicle that generated the ability to close this loan, or for the creditor to extend a credit to the debtor. And if it's found out to be a stolen object, he's protected by Takanat HaShuk, because otherwise he would never have lent the money. On the other hand, Shaveh b'Shaveh, if he lends out money on par with the collateral, then Amemar Amar lo asabo takanat hashuk. Amemar says there is no takanat hashuk in that way, because nobody lends at a loan-to-value ratio of 100%. Whenever you mortgage a house, when you buy property, you borrow against it, the creditors always want more protection than the value of the loan. So you have to have a 50%, a 30%, whatever the loan-to-value ratio is, but it's certainly not going to be one-for-one. And if that's the circumstance, he lent on a one-to-one basis, that means he's really not relying on the collateral, because he's taking too little collateral to protect his loan. And for that reason, he doesn't get takanat hashuk, because it seems like he would have lent the money even without the collateral, or he's not really relying on this stolen collateral. He still gets takanat hashuk in that case, because he lent the money. Yes, he might not have done it in a manner that he has full protection, but he knows that he has a certain amount of protection from this collateral, and that's sufficient grounds for him to then lend out the money, rather than saying that he's not really relying on the collateral. If that's the case, if he lent it out relying on the collateral, then he is entitled to takanat hashuk, of the protection, as if he's a lokeach. Zvina shaveh b'shaveh. If a person buys an object at the proper market price, asubo takanat hashuk, then he's protected by takanat hashuk, this indemnification, that if it is a stolen good, that he doesn't have to return it without payment from the ba'alim. On the other hand, shaveh meya b'matan, if he bought something worth 100 for 200, Rav Sheshit Amar lo asaba takanat hashuk. Rav Sheshit says he doesn't get protection there, he's not afforded protection over there. And as Rashi notes over here, it's because if he paid 200 for an object worth 100, he's really gifting the money to the individual. He's overpaying him for the object, and that means that he's gifting the money. A gift is not subject to protection of takanat hashuk. If it was a purchase, that's one thing, but here where he's overpaying, it's clear that he's making it as a gift rather than a purchase. On the other hand, Rav Amar subo takanat hashuk, he does get that protection here. As Rashi notes over here, even though 100 of it is a gift, the other 100 is a transaction, and therefore he's protected because of the transactional side of that, the 100 that was a transaction. But when he gets the protection, not only does he get the protection for the transactional side, he will also get the protection for the additional money that he laid out. And therefore, if the Balim come now and want to take the object back, they're going to have to pay him the 200 and not the 100. The Gemara concludes now, V'hilchata b'kulu asubo takanat hashuk. Every one of these items takanat hashuk applies to. The exception of the first two cases that we brought, which is when he uses the stolen merchandise to repay a loan or to repay credit that was extended to him. Because in that situation, again, the loans were initiated without the collateral of this object of payment in mind. And therefore, you can come and take it away from the creditor because he's not necessarily entitled to it or he didn't rely on it. And if it's stolen, it should go back to its rightful owner without any compensation to the creditor. The creditor is just in the same circumstance he was before. The debtor owes him money. And that hasn't changed, even if we take back the payment that he made or the object to which he made that payment. Now, Tosafot over here says the Gemara's conclusion of the Hilchata is only in cases where there was a machloket. When the Gemara comes and concludes and says, all of these have the application of Takanat HaShuk, that's only in the two machlokot that we spoke about, that of a Meimar and Marzutra with regards to extending a loan equal to the level of the collateral, and the case of where he overpays for an object, the machlok between Rav Sheshet and Rava. In both those cases, the Gemara is paskening that there is takanat shuk. But in the instances where the Gemara here noted that there is no takanat shuk, for instance, up above where Rava said if it's a ganav mifursam, there's no takanat shuk. There's no machloket. This hilchata does not apply to that or does not undermine that. So the hilchata is only coming to machria to make a decision with regards to cases where there is a machloket. If there is no machloket, then we go by whatever was stated there, like Rava before, stated that by a ganav mifursam there is no takanat shuk. Avimei bar Gazi chamua de Ravina. So Avimei bar Gazi was the father-in-law of Ravina. Avimesik ba ugavra arba azuze. He was a creditor to this individual. He had lent him 4 zuz. Ganav glima ache nihale. The debtor stole a cloak and then gave it to the creditor to Avimei bar Gazi. Osve arba azuze achrine. So at that point, Avimei then extended credit to him and lent him another 4 zuz. The sofu karaganav. In the end, they realize that the merchandise was stolen, and they know who the thief is. Ata de kamei de Ravina, so they came before Ravina, meaning his father-in-law came before him with this case. Amar kamai ganavu farachovo, velo b'mayti le velo mide. As far as the original loan is concerned, that loan was extended, that credit was extended even without the cloak that's there. And therefore, it falls under the category of someone who is utilizing the theft in order to repay a loan. And over there, there's no takanat shuk. And the owner of the cloak could take that back without having to make compensation to Ravina's father-in-law because the credit was extended even without the glima. Hanachar be zuze achrine, the second loan that was extended, shakol zuzeich vadar glime. There he can make a demand for payment for the cloak. So then the father-in-law of Ravina can demand that the original owner of the cloak pay him 4 zuz and then take his cloak back. So he's still out 4 zuz from the original loan that he made. But at least with regards to the second loan, he's protected by takanat shuk. And for the balim, again, that protection of the takanat shuk means he's going to have to pay the lokeach for getting his glima back, but he has to pay him for things that were caused or losses that were caused because of the stolen item. So now, matkif la Rav Kohen. Rav Kohen says, Ravina, how do you know that that's the right way to explain this circumstance? What Ravina says is, the original loan was not repaid with the Gneva, and there's no protection of Takanat HaShuk. Second loan was only extended because the Ganav had given the cloak in, and that's what precipitated the second loan. And therefore, he's afforded protection of Takanat HaShuk with regards to the second loan. Rav Kohen says, V'dilma glima b'hane zuze kama yahava nihale. Maybe the cloak that he's bringing back was not to precipitate or generate the second loan, but rather to repay the first loan. And ganavu fara b'chovo, ganavu fara b'chufo. And in that situation, we already know that you don't get it back. The creditor can't make a demand of the balim to pay him in order to get the cloak back, because there is no protection of takanat shuk in that case. And the reason he lent out the second 4 zuz is not because he has the cloak in hand, but because he trusted the guy. Like he trusted him in the first loan, so too he trusted him in the second loan. Because now it looks like he gave an extent of the first loan, and now he's repaying it. So why shouldn't he expect to be get repaid if he extends a loan a second time? And so Rav Kohen says, Ravina, I'm not sure that you're looking at this correctly. You're assuming, okay, the first 4 zuz, he doesn't get anything back. The second 4 zuz, he gets something back because he's lending him based on the cloak that's here. Rav Kohen says, how do you know that? He might be lending him because he trusts him. He got paid back for the first loan, and that was what the cloak was doing, and there he's not entitled to takanat shuk. The second loan he extended on trust, like he did with the first loan. And therefore he has no recourse against the balim, and the balim can take their glima back, and the creditor here, the father of the Ravina, is out 8 zuz. Yigalga milta, mata de kami de Rabbi Avu. So this case eventually made its way down to Rabbi Abba Omar, Hilchata Rav Kohen. And he says that the law is like Rav Kohen, that Rav Kohen's right over here, that you can't make an assumption that the second loan was premised on the cloak, and therefore he is entitled to protection of Takanat HaShuk. Say that no, that the cloak was used to repay the first loan, and the second loan was independent, and it was done on trust, and then therefore he has no recourse, there's no Takanat HaShuk in that case. Narsha Ganav Safra. A person from Narsha stole a sefer. Zavne le Popuna, he sold it to someone from Popuna, Bitamnin Zuze, for 80 zuz. Azal Papuna, the person in Papuna took it, and Zavne the Bar Mechuza b'mei avesrim zuz, for 120 zuz. Lebesov hukara ganav. In the end, they figure out that this guy from Narsha was a thief, and he had stolen it. In the case of this theft, he sells it to the first buyer, and then the first buyer sells it to a second buyer. Amar Abai, Lizel Mari the Safra, the owner of the Sefer should go, v'yayvila le Bar Mechuza tamnon, zuze. He should give the person from Mechuza 80 zuz, the shakel safre, and take back his sefer. Vazal bar Mechuza v'shakel arba in mi papuna. And then the person from Mechuza should go back to the first seller and say to him, give me the additional 40 that I paid for you, because the object now was taken back. It was really an object of theft, and therefore you weren't entitled to your money. So I got a refund of the 80 already, because the Balim paid me that 80. But as far as my 120, which is an additional 40, that I want from you, Lokech then is responsible to pay him that additional 40 amount that he took in excess of what he spent with the Ganav. And then the second buyer will go after the Ganav for the 80 zuz, and the first buyer will go after the Ganav for the 40 zuz. Matkiflorova hashta Lokech mi Ganav asubo tokanat ashuk. Rava says, wait a minute, when a person buys directly from the thief, he's granted this protection of Tanakan Ashuk. Lokeach min lokeach mi bai? In a case where it's a buyer from a buyer, where the second buyer clearly is innocent here because he has no connection to the gazlan or the ganav at all. He doesn't think this is a hot merchandise. He thinks that someone bought it, and now that individual is selling it to him. And so he's much more removed from the situation, and therefore should be afforded takanat hashuk, because how would he have known, or how should he have known, that it came from a stolen source? Elama Rava. So the Rava says the psak should have been the following, not like what Abayi suggested, but rather the psak should be like this. Lezel mari de safra, v'yayiv le de bar mechuza me'av esrin zuze. The owner of the sefer should go to the person in mechuza, who is the final buyer who paid 120 zuz for it, and he should pay him 120 zuz. Shokel safra, and then he'll take back his sefer. Lezel mari de safra, v'lishko arba'im mi papuna. And then the owner of the sefer can go after the guy in Papuna who profited 40 zuz and take back the 40 zuz from him. The tamnan bin arshon, and then go after the final 80 zuz from the thief himself. And thereby Rova is providing takanat shuk to the final buyer, and therefore he's refunded all of his money. And even the first buyer is afforded takanat shuk in some way, because he only loses out his profit, not the underlying principal. And the underlying principal amount, Balim will have to go after the ganav for, and neither of the lochim, neither of the buyers will be on the hook for that money. So Rova provides takanat shuk both for the first buyer and the second buyer, whereas Rabaya only provides that protection for the first buyer, not for the second buyer. Alright, the Mishnah says, Zeba b'chavitov shel yayim, zeba b'kadosh shel dvash. One guy is coming with his barrel of wine, the other one with his barrel of honey. Nistaka chavit shel dvash. The barrel carrying the dvash somehow got punctured or fell apart. V'shafak zet yeno. The other guy dumps his wine. V'tzila the dvash l'tocho. And then he saves the dvash into his barrel. The obvious assumption here in the Mishnah is that the honey is worth a lot more than the wine. In all these circumstances, we saw that with regards to the takanot of Yoshua before, that when you have this type of differential in price, then we assume societally that it's better that we save the object with the higher value, because out of that object with the higher value, you can repay the individual who lost something of a lower value, plus the other person will benefit from the fact that we save something of a much higher value, and therefore it's zenene v'zenene, and that's a better outcome than this guy walks off with his wine, and the other guy loses his dvash. But in this scenario, the Mishnah says, "Ein lo elas scharo." He's only entitled to the repayment of his schar, as Rashi notes over here, schar kli, the renting out of his kli for the yayin, v'schar pi'ula, and it's working on it. What he doesn't get, and what the Mishnah says, is that he's not entitled to the wine over here, a repayment for the lost wine. The reason being, and we noted this before, is because nobody asked him to do this. He was a good Samaritan. He decided to do this of his own volition. If he does it of his own volition, he's not entitled to repayment for the wine, only for the time and effort that he put in. If he specifically stipulates that, I'm going to dump my wine, but you're going to pay for that wine in order to save your stuff, then chayav liteno. Then the owner of the devash is obligated to repay him for the loss of wine in that scenario. It's not clear here whether you need positive affirmation from the owner of the devash or simply his silence is acquiescence. The statement is being made by the owner of the wine. It's clear if the owner of the devash spoke up and he's the one who asked the balayayin to do this, that he would for sure have to repay the balayayin for the yayin. But in a case here where the balayayin is saying it voluntarily and he's telling him this is the condition of what I'm doing, whether that's sufficient because the balim did not stop him, or the balim have to give him positive affirmation, yes, go ahead and do it. It's not clear here from the Mishnah, and it's actually machloket in the Mefarshim here as to how to explain it, with obvious nafgamino, the halacha. Shotof nachal chamoro v'chamor chaviro. A river overflowed and then washed away his donkey and his friend's donkey. Shelo yafim maneh. His is worth 100 zuz. Shel chaviro matayim and his friend's is worth 200 zuz. V'niach et zed shelo v'tzil et shel chaviro. He let his donkey go and saved his friend's donkey because it was worth more money. Ein lo ela scharo. Again, there, he's only entitled to the value of his services of saving the donkey. He does not get repaid or get the money back for his donkey that he let go in order to save his friend's donkey. If he specifically stipulated, I'm going to let my donkey go and then recover your donkey and you're going to pay me out of that money for my donkey, then he's obligated to pay him in that instance. So over here, again, if he does it of his own volition without any interaction with the other owner, he's entitled to the value or the rental value of his utensil, plus the payment for what you would have to hire someone to do this, whether it was the case of the saving the honey or the case of saving the chamor. What he's not entitled to is lost wages. What he's not entitled to is repayment for the wine that he spilt out or the chamor that he lost. And the reason being is that he didn't stipulate it. He could have asked the Balaim to ensure that that was the case. The fact that he didn't is his own loss. Again, if he does stipulate it, then he is entitled to all of those things. V'amai, the Gemara says, why is it over here that he has to give the stuff back to the original owner? Leme leme hefkera kazachina. He can say that it's coming from hefker. He can basically make the claim, look, if you're not going to pay me back for my wine, then your honey would not have been saved. If your honey wasn't saved, it's basically going to ibud, it's going to a loss, and that makes it the equivalent of hefker. So when I acquired it from hefker. I'm not going to give you your honey back at all. I'm actually going to take the honey for myself, as if it was an aveda that I found out on the street. Milo Tanya, don't we have a braita that supports that understanding that once something is going to ibud, that it's hefker? He was carrying along barrels or pitchers full of wine and oil. And they are beginning to crack or they're breaking apart. Lo yomar, at that moment he shouldn't say, this person shouldn't say all of a sudden, listen, this stuff's all going to get wasted and lost. I may as well not be my stuff that's lost. I'll give it to Truma and Maser. And then the Truma and Maser will get lost, but at least then I won't sustain a personal monetary loss. It'll just be that the Truma and the Maser are lost in that situation. So he cannot do that, or he cannot say that. V'imamar, and if he does say it, lo amar klum, it doesn't work. Not only doesn't it work lechatchila, even b'diavad, it doesn't work. And from there you would conclude, as Rashi notes over here, that when it's holech li'ibut, when it's going to be lost, it's considered to be hefker out of your balut, it's not under your ownership anymore, and therefore you have no right to make it into truman maser, because you don't own it. You have to own the items in order to make them into true maser, and here you don't own them. Tosafot tries to deal with the problem of that it's a violation of shalom min ha-mukaf, which is that you're not allowed to take off trumot ha-masrot unless they're adjacent to the item from which you are taking the trumot ha-masrot. And over here, he's taking them off in the middle of the shuk or wherever he's going, nowhere near the peirot that he's trying to be mafrish for. So Tosafot either gives an answer, which is that it's right before Shabbat and Yom Tov, where he doesn't have sufficient time to get home or to do it min ha-mukaf, and therefore under that duress, we give him a dispensation to take afilu shalom min ha-mukaf, or you can argue that he wasn't doing anything right here, but the braita is coming to teach you that despite the fact that he's doing shalom min ha-mukaf, it should have worked bidiavad. The fact that it doesn't work even bidiavad shows you that holech li'ibud is like hefker and he has no rights of ownership anymore. My answer is, gedamer irmiya, shakal beit abad karuch aleha. That there's a basket of the olive press that is wrapped around it. Hachanami, so to in our case, she'akal beit abad karuch aleha. The basket of the olive press is wrapped around it. We'll see Rabbi Yirmiyah's answer later on with regards to another situation. But what he's saying here is that the individual has a cracked pitcher or barrel, but it's contained inside of a basket. This is a basket normally where they stored the olives before they went to the press. and the olives would soften in there. And then eventually they would take them to the press, on which there was a very large beam with stones hanging from it. And then they used to press the olives inside the basket. The reason to do that is so that they don't go flying away from the press. If you didn't have something that contained them or had walls around it, when you pressed them, they would slide to the outside to avoid the pressure. So in order to keep them there, what they do is they keep the olives inside the basket, and then they press the olives inside the basket. Now, obviously, the baskets are porous to allow the oil to pass through or to come out of there, but they are not completely porous where everything comes pouring out. So in this situation where he has a pitcher or a barrel that's broken, but it's still enwrapped in this basket, then the loss is not like a loss where it's all going to be gone, the ibud, but it's going to slowly drip out. And therefore, it wasn't a guarantee that he was going to lose everything over here, and that's why in our Mishnah, it's not considered to be the ibud that's hefker and you can just take it, but rather it's a slow loss, and therefore he might al yedei dechak been able to save it or get someone else to save it. So your interceding over here didn't necessarily save the day, because it was possible that they could have saved this even without you, and that's why it's not considered to be holich li ibud, and it's not considered as if you took it from hefker, as opposed to the case of truma. By the Kadeh Yain and the Kadeh Shemin, there was nothing protecting them, and when they leaked, they were going to totally leak out and be lost. There, where it's going to Ibud, there, it's not considered that you have Balut or their Hefker. Over here, where it was a slower process of loss, there we don't say that it's Olechli Ibud as the clone of Hefker. Now, the Gemara challenges this piece of the Bright that it says, V'im Amar Lo Amar Klum, is it really true that Bidi Avad, if he does this when it's going to Ibud, that it doesn't work? Vahatanya, we have a brayta that seems to disagree with that conclusion. Mi sheba b'derech umaot biyado. Person's coming back from a trip and he's got monies on him. Vanas kenegdo. And then he has some sort of strongman, marauder, thief, robber opposite of him. And he knows what's going to happen next. This guy's going to come and shake him down and take all of his money. Lo yomare perot sheyeshli b'toch beiti. I have these fruits of maaser sheni in my house. I'm going to redeem them onto this money. That money then will be ma'ot ma'aser sheni. And if the guy steals them, then he's stealing ma'ot ma'aser sheni. I'm not going to sustain then any personal loss or less of a personal loss, because then it's ma'ot ma'aser sheni being lost, not my personal money that's being lost. So he's not supposed to do this l'chatchila. But if he does it b'diavad, dvarav kayamim, it does work. So you see over here, even when something's holechli ibud, like in the situation where he's about to be robbed, then you're not allowed to do it the chatchila, but bidyavad, if you did do it, it is successful at transferring the kedusha onto the money. So why don't we say the same thing by the trumot de masrot? Why can't he make them into trumot de maser bidyavad? Marseh zachem ha'eskinan b'shiachol atzil. It's a case where he can save it. Marseh z'ibichol atzil l'chatchila amai lo yomar. If he can save it from this anas, then why l'chatchila can't he redeem his ma'aser sheni on this money? Magar says, v'shechol atzil yedei dechak. Now, he can't necessarily save it in an easy manner, but there might be some probability or some outlandish way where he could save it, or under duress he could save it. Then in that situation, b'diavad, it's not considered to be totally the ibud and totally hefker. But in the case of the Truma Maser before, where it's going to ibud and there's no way to save it whatsoever, there it's considered or deemed to be hefker. So anytime there's a case where you have a loss, l'chatchila, you shouldn't do such a thing. Tosfot over here notes that Rashi doesn't have the word l'chatchila in his girsa, even though in our Gemara Rashi does have it. The Bach tries to deal with that in the girsa of Rashi. Anywhere there's a loss, do we say l'chatchila, you shouldn't do this? So the way that it's structured in our Gemara, that's a question on the previous Braita, which is that the Braita which said that Bidyavadi could do it, the Chatchila shouldn't do it, was a situation where Yechol Atzila Yedei Dechak. Now the Gemara is challenging that. Even when there's a Chatzala Yedei Dechak, is it really true that the Chatchila you can't do it? That may not be the case. And we're going to see in a second in another Braita. The Balei Tosafot, who claimed that Rashi had this Girsa, but it's not in the Rashi that we have in front of us, say that the word the Chatchila should not be here. And rather, the question is, is it really true anytime that there's hefseid that you're not allowed to do this? And it's referencing back to the original brayta that we brought, which says, v'im amar lo amar klum, that if he does it, it doesn't work at all. But here we have a brayta that shows you that when you do it, even though it's going to hefseid, that you're allowed to do this, b'diavad. So Tosfot sees it as a question on the original brayta, whereas the girsa that we have in front of us has sees it as a question on the brayta that we just brought now, which seem to say that the chatchila you shouldn't redeem the money in this way, but b'diavad you could. But now we're asking, wait a minute, is that really true that even chatchila you can't? Vatanya, we have this bright asher lo eser chaviot shel tevel tamei. He has 10 barrels or pitchers full of tevel that is tamei. V'ra'achad mehem shenishbira o shenitgalta. He sees one of them is bursting or breaking and now leaking or leaching the wine or the oil that's inside of it. Or it was exposed and now it might be restricted from being eaten or utilized because a snake might have deposited its venom inside of it. Omer, harehi trumat maser al teisha chavrota. Now, when we say it's tevel here, it's only tevel for trumat maser. And so he has to be mafresh to trumat maser. You have 10 here. 1/10 of 10 is 1. So he's going to make this barrel that has this problem into the trumat maser. But by oil, he shouldn't do this because of the loss of the kohen. So if we're talking about wine in these barrels, then the kohen can't do anything with the tamei wine. It's not useful to him. So now that wine that's going to go to loss anyway because it's already tamei, there's no incremental or additional real loss that's caused by you in assigning the trumat maser to the barrel that's leaking. Because even if it didn't leak and you made it into trumat maser and you gave it to the kohen, he's going to end up with tamei wine, which he has to get rid of anyway and can't utilize. Because tamei truma is something that has to be disposed of or burnt and cannot be utilized. So it wouldn't have been utilized with a kohen anyway. So the loss here is very minimal. On the other hand, if it's oil, we know that with regards to tamei oil, the kohen is allowed to, in his destruction of that oil, benefit from it. He could light it as a fire, utilize it for heat or for light, whatever he chooses to do when he burns it. So in the case of the oil, we say you cannot do this, because if you sign the trumat maser to this barrel that's burst or leaking, then the kohen's going to lose out. He would have gotten this tamei oil or tamei truma that he could have utilized. Now he's going to get nothing because it's all going to ibud. So in the case where there's a large loss, we say you can't do it. But in cases where there is a small loss to the kohen, there we say you can do it the chatchila. So what you see from this braita is the fact that the shemen lo yaseke mipnei hefsed hakohen means that it would work to make this into trumat maser, even though it's going like ibud, and that shows you the chatchila you could have done it. It's only because of this mitigating factor of hefsed hakohen that we don't let you do it. Had it not been for that, we would have let you do this, even the chatchila. And that's the nature of the question here. What do you mean the chatchila you shouldn't do this? This braita seems to indicate the chatchila you can do this, had it not been for the hefsed hakohen. Or according to those that say that the questions on the original braita, where it says b'diavad lo amar v'lo klum, over here, how is the braita suggesting that you can be mafrish, this trumat maser, from this object if it's going li'ibud? Because here, even though it's li'ibud, nevertheless we allow you to be mafrish, trumot and masro from it, at a b'diavad level. The Gemara's answer is, the original Rabbi Yirmiyah, kishakal beit abad karuch aleh. It's a case here where there's a basket that is protecting it from dripping out in an excessive manner. According to Tosafot, who says the question's about the original case, over here it's not the ibud. It's what we answered for our Mishnah. It's not completely the ibud, and so this case is different than the case of the Braita that said, b'diavad, you can't even do it, because there it's really the ibud. Over here, it's slowly going the ibud, and therefore it has a different dynamic, and it's not considered to be hefker, and it's not considered to be as if it's gone there, and that's why you can be mafrish trumot masrot. According to those that put in the gears of the chatchila over here, the reason that you're allowed to do it in our case, the chatchila, is because the loss here, when you make it into truma, is not so extensive. It's a small loss. And that's what allows you to do it, the chatchila. But in a case where there's a real loss involved, there you can't do it. And that's why in the case of Atzil Yedei Dechak, over there we say that there is a real loss involved. It still may not be at the level of the Kohen by the Shemen Tamei, where we can't even let you do it because it's such a big loss, but it's still above the level of the wine that's being lost here, because the wine here is dripping out at a very slow rate because of the basket that's around it. And therefore, when you make it into Trumat Maser, it's not as if it's going to disappear immediately. In the case of the Maot Meiser Sheni, that you redeem them onto the money, you can't save it al Yedei Dachak, but the most likely outcome here is that you're going to lose it. And therefore that loss exceeds what we would like you to do in these situations. And that loss makes it as if it is the ibud. And therefore we would say the chatchila, you shouldn't do it. Now the Gemara says, Bishlamad mashnish b'chazia, yalanit galta, the maichazia. If it's broken, then you can still utilize the item that's in it, this oil that's inside of it. On the other hand, if it was left open or exposed and a snake might have deposited his venom in it, then it's not ra'ui anymore for anything. So how could you be mafrish, trumot, trumat maser, into this item when it's completely worthless or has no value. It's already le'ibud. If you want to say that he can still use that wine to sprinkle it, v'atanya ma'im shinit galu, waters that were left exposed overnight, he shouldn't dump them out into the public domain. And he shouldn't use them to mix up the cement or the plaster. And you can't use it to settle down the dust in the house. And you shouldn't give it to your animal to drink. Rashi says, because if you give it to your animal to drink, you might shecht it, and then the poison will be inside the animal. Tosafot says that irrespective of whether you're going to eat the animal or not, even if it's a behemah tmeah, you're not allowed to give it to it because it's baal tashchit. It's going to kill the animal, and then you're wasting a life of an animal for no reason. V'lo behemah tchevero, and you can't give it to your friend's animal to eat. And so, what is the value of this wine in order to make it into trumat maser? The Braita indicates that if it was exposed overnight, or it was bursting and broken and leaking out because the utensil had broken, that you could still use those for trumat maser when we're talking about wine. Again, when it's a case where it's broken and it's seeping out slowly, especially with this basket around it, then you can utilize the wine before it all seeps out. You can use it to sprinkle in the house so that it smells nice and give a nice aroma to the house and help settle down the dust. But in terms of nitgalta, if it was left exposed overnight, there we don't allow you to use that item no matter what, even for purposes other than consumption. Because we're afraid that that poison will then permeate or come into contact with the person, and that will endanger their life. So we have to say you have to spill it out in a place where nobody's going to be injured by it. But that makes it completely worthless. Gemara says, davar la b'misanenet. It's a case where you put it through a filter. Kirabi Nechemia, like the position of Nechemia, the Tanya, misanenet yesh ba mishum gilui, a filter still has a din of gilui, according to the Tanakama. Amar Nechemia, ematai. When is that true? That's when the lower filter is open. If the lower area is covered up, even if the upper area is exposed, there's no problem of gilui. The fish, the venom of a snake is similar to a sponge. And it floats and stays in place. So what is being suggested here, we'll explain it according to Rashi, is that the filter sits between the upper and lower utensils, and so you pour the wine into the upper utensil, and then it slowly goes through the filter into the lower utensil. If the lower utensil is covered by this filter, then anything that's found in the lower utensil does not have a problem of gilui, because the snake could not make direct access to that lower part because of the blocking of the filter. And if the snake deposits the poison in the upper kli that's above the filter, that's fine, because Rabbi Nechemia says that the venom of the snake will not penetrate through the filter. It'll be stuck on top with the rest of the shmarim, the sediment that's there. And so whatever you have on the bottom is then clean and cleared of that poison. On the other hand, if the snake still has access to the lower utensil without it having to pass through the filter, then the lower wine is also problematic because snake might have deposited venom in the lower one. And Tosafot notes that even though that doesn't sound like much of a chiddush, because of course, if the lower one is open, that he can deposit the venom in there directly. So Tosafot suggests that maybe the chiddush here is the fact that the snake might be afraid to go in the lower one because of the echo or because of being caught, and therefore you might have thought that the lower one should be protected even if it was slightly exposed. Kamash Malam, that if there's any exposure there, that we have to fear the snake directly depositing the venom into that location. So what the Gemara is suggesting now is that you could take that wine with the eris in it, filter it, and after you filter it, it is still usable. So there is some residual value that's left there enough that you can make it into trumat maser before it goes the ibut. Gemara says, v'labit marala. Didn't we qualify this statement of Reb Nechemia and say the following? Am Reb Simon, Am Reb Yishum and Levi, lo shanu ela shelo tarko. That's only if he did not mix it up. Aval tarko, asur. But if he mixes it up, it's problematic because the filter only works when the venom itself is still very viscous and it binds together and it won't pass through the filter. Now then, if you stirred it up with the wine, that causes it to separate, and then it'll become smaller particles within the wine, and that could pass through the filter. So in our situation where the venom is already deposited into the wine, and now you want to put it through a filter, that already means that it's going to get mixed before it goes through the filter. It's one thing if the filter's in place and the wine's sitting on the utensil above the filter and slowly filtering through, and the snake deposits its venom on top. We're not going to touch the upper barrel. It's just going to sit there, and that will cause, and that will be stopped by the filter as the wine goes through. The venom will not go through. The other thing, if we have to now take the barrel and put it through a filter, that's going to cause it to get mixed up inside of there, and that filter will then not be efficacious in separating out the venom from that wine. Where it says, no, atamnami, in the case where the wine was already exposed, you can put efshar de manachmide puma de chavita. You can actually put the filter directly on the top of the barrel of the pitcher, the shafile, and then pour it out. So it would not force you to cause it to be mixed or stirred around when you pour it onto the filter, because you'll put the filter directly on the utensil that it's in now, and then just turn it over and let it filter. So there won't be any mixing or stirring of the item. Now the Gemara challenges, can we really set this up that Rabbi Nechemiah is the author of this position? Rabbi Nechemiah mitar minan. Since when does Rabbi Nechemiah allow you to take off truma in this manner? We're now saying that Rabbi Nechemiah is the author of this braita, because he's the one who allows you to use mayim migulim or yayin migulin if they go through a filter. And that's why they have residual value that you can make them into trumat maser. But the problem is, this is trumat maser or tevel that is tamei. Are you allowed to then be mafrish bituma? Batanya, tormimina tamei la tamei. You're allowed to separate from something that's tamei on something else that's tamei. Umina tohor la tohor. Or from something that is pure on something that is pure, meaning that's the obvious, which is that from tahor and tahor you can do tamei and tamei. Mina tahor la tamei. And you can also take off from the tahor on the tamei, because then you're benefiting the kohen. The object which you're separating from is tamei. But now if you use the tahor stuff to make it into truma, or to make it into trumat maser, then that will be usable or edible by the kohen. So that's an upgrade in a sense, because the chulin that remains behind, if it's tamei, is no problem, and you can utilize it. And the trumot that you're being mafrished, now that you're making them that they are tahorim, that's great. What you can't do is take objects that are tahor and then be mafrish something that is tamei on those objects that are tahor, because then that truma is going to go, the ibud is going to be wasted because you can't utilize it. But Rabbi Nechemiah argues on the Tanakhama and says, af mina tamei la tamei lo hitiru litrom elo bishel demai, that Chazal did not allow you to be mafrish from an object that is tamei and then mafrish truma or trumat maser that is tamei from it. They only allowed you to do that by grains or items that are from the Amea Aretz, that are demai, where they have a safek whether the Trumot and Masrot were taken off of them. Since Ala Rov, there's a chazakah that the Amea Aretz did or were mafrish Trumot and Masrot. Therefore, we can rely on that in cases of safek like this and allow you to take off from the Tamei Ala Tamei, because in all likelihood, you don't really need to take it out. Even though there's a minority that didn't, and it's a significant minority, still, Ala Rov, that's not the case. But in a case we know for sure that the both of them are Tamei and they are Tevel, we're not going to allow you to be Mafrish the Truma from there, because then that Truma goes to Ibud. We're going to say to you, bring over some Tahor stuff, be Mafrish it, and then you'll be able to give it to the Kohen. So, Achanami, Bishel Demai. So that's my answer, is that it must be that this Braita, if we're going to make Rabbi Nechemiah the author, has to be done in a case of Demai. Amamar, Umeshemen lo yaseke mipnei hefseid Kohen. We don't allow you to do this with the oil, because there the Kohen sustains real loss if you allow it to go to Ibud versus making it Tamei. Maishna Shemen. Why is shemen worth so much more when it's tamei than wine that's tamei when it's truma or trumat maser? Because by shemen ra'ui lahadlik, because there you can use it to light with or for fire. Yayinami ra'ui liziluf. Wine, even though it's tamei, has value as a truma or trumat maser tmeah, because you can do it li'ibud, you can get rid of it by sprinkling it, and that ziluf is a utilization that has value. B'chitei maziluf lav miltahi. If you say that sprinkling is not really worth anything, it's not of a real value, so it's not considered to be significant. V'amar Shmuel mishum Rabbi Chiya, shotim elug besela. You drink wine at the size of a lug, and it costs you one sela. Umazalfim elug b'shtayim, and the wine that you utilize for sprinkling cost two sela per lug. I mean, it's more expensive wine because you need something that has a strong aroma to it in order to be valuable as a ziluf for sprinkling around and to give off that nice smell. So it's even worth more than drinking wine. So there is a significant value over here. So my answer is, hachamai eskinan b'chadash. We're talking about new wine, grape juice, which doesn't have any aroma or smell to it, and therefore it can't be used for ziluf. V'ha'yarawi liyashno. You can just keep it around and let it age. And as it ages, it will ferment and get that wonderful smell to it, and then you could utilize it once it has aged. Ata beli de takala. We're worried about the fact that if he has to keep it around, then the kohen will have a problem with it. I mean, it's trumat me'ah, or trumat maser me'ah, and that cannot be eaten. And there's a chiyuv mita b'dei shemayim if it's eaten, if it's trumat me'ah. And so we don't want to keep it around where there's a possibility that people will make a mistake and utilize it. So if it can be gotten rid of immediately, we're fine with the kohen getting benefit from it in that circumstance. But if it's in a situation where he has to store it or keep it around for a long duration of time, there's a lot of risk involved. I says, Shemen Nami Atali Day Dakala. Wait a minute. You're allowing him to keep oil around, and then keeping the oil around to light with it, he might keep it around for a long duration, and there's risk there. The Manach B'lekei Maos, because he puts it into a disgusting utensil. Once he's done that, nobody's going to eat this oil anymore because it's in a dish or something that's putrid, and so it's good for lighting oil. It's good for fuel, but it's not good for putting in your salad dressing anymore or utilizing in your cooking because it's rancid. So you can do the same thing with the wine. Put it into a utensil that's not good or is putrid in some way, and therefore nobody will come to drink it. Doesn't make sense. The way you're trying to utilize it as ziluf for sprinkling is something that is supposed to smell nice, have a good odor to it. Now you're putting it into a disgusting item, and nobody's going to want to sprinkle that all around. In addition, if you're trying to ferment it so that it produces a nice smell, if you put it into a disgusting utensil, that's not going to be the result of putting the wine or leaving it around in that situation. The Gemara then says, and this issue of whether we worry about keeping around items that can lead to problems, do we worry about that? Is a machloket tanaim. Detanya, chavit shel yayin shel truma shenit meit. If you have wine that, of truma that became tmei'ah, which needs now to be gotten rid of, you have to spill it all out immediately, because we worry about takala, and we want you to get rid of it immediately. You keep it around, and you sprinkle it, and you utilize it in that manner. I will be a decisive force here, between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. If you're in the house, and you have the wine here, where it can be used for ziluf, then you can keep it around and use it for ziluf, because it'll get used up, and it has value. Bisadeh, if you're out in the field where you can't utilize it for ziluf, tishafei chakol, then you spill the whole thing out. Ige de amri, some say biyashan taseh ziluf. The hachra'ah that he said is if it's already aged wine, that's where Beit Hillel says you should do ziluf with it, because then it already has the odor that is good for ziluf. Ubechadash, but when it is newer wine, meaning like grape juice, tishafei chakol, you spill the whole thing out because you'd have to keep it around for a long duration, and that we don't want. And so Rabbi Yishmael, but Rabbi Yossi is trying to come up with this compromise position between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And generally, we believe that the halacha is like the machria. So Rabbi Yishmael, but Rabbi Yossi is trying to set himself up in a position by which he is a compromised position that will also be normative, meaning that the halacha will be like him. Amrulo, they respond to him, in hachra shlishit machrat, that a third party creating a hachra is not a hachra. The way that Rashi explains it is, if you have two opinions that mention something, and then a third opinion comes along and takes a portion of that opinion from one and a portion of the opinion from the other, that's called a compromise position. So, for instance, in our case, had Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel mentioned, for instance, Beit Hillel would say, you can keep it around, whether you're in the field or whether you're in the house, you can keep it around. And Beit Shammai says, even if you're in the house, even if you're in the field, you can't keep it around. So then that means that they both mentioned the house and the field, and they have differing opinions. Then Rabbi Shmuel's opinion would be, listen, in the house you can keep it around. In the field you can't keep it around. The reason then that the compromised position would be acceptable halacha is because now we have two against one in every situation. In the situation of the house, both Beit Hillel and Rabbi Shmuel but Rabbi Yossi are saying that you can do ziluf. Beit Shammai is saying no, that's two against one. The halacha will be that you can do it in the house. Out in the field, Rabbi Shmuel is saying you can't do it. So joined together with Beit Shammai, who says you also can't do it out in the field, now you have two opinions saying in the field you got to pour it out completely versus Beit Hillel says you don't. And that's why we would decide the halacha according to Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Yossi, because in that situation, he is basically taking a portion of each of their opinions and then he's making it two against one in each of those situations. But in our scenario over here, since both Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai never made any mention of the field or the house, when Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Yossi comes along and gives his quote-unquote compromise position, he's really creating a third position that has nothing to do with the two previous positions. He's actually stating a third stance. And in that case, you're not deemed to be a machriya. And as Rashi says, Tamatz Machat Omer, you're saying something of your own. It's an independent statement. V'lo k'divrei echad mishneihem. It's not like either one of them. You're not taking up any portion of the position of either one of them. You're actually coming up with this totally newfangled idea. And that's not considered to be a hachra'ah. And therefore, Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi would be considered to be a dat yachid versus Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And there is no hachra'ah over here. On the other hand, the Baalei HaTosafot, who think that Rashi's explanation is correct, and the Ri says that he favors Rashi's position, brings that the Rabbeinu Tam had a different definition of hachra'ah and eno machria, which is that you can only be a machria if you're in the same generation as the other two parties that are being cholek. So over here we have Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai have a machloket. If someone from their generation came in as a compromised position, then we would say there, halacha kimachriya, and the halacha would follow the position of that compromise. On the other hand, here, like in our scenario, Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi is from a generation after Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. His hachra'ah is not considered to be a compromised position because he's not on par with those tana'im about whom he's trying to make a compromise. And so then when he appears in the Mishnah, he's not a compromise between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai, he's actually a generation later. And that makes it as if he's a totally new opinion, not an opinion that is really compromising between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. And so the Rabbeinu Tam suggests it has to do whether he's a Talmid or he's a peer. If he's a peer, then it's a compromised position, l'alocha. If he's a Talmid, if he's a next generation individual, then his compromise is considered to be a dat yachid and not be machriya. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Kuf Tet Zayin Amud Aleph.